So here we are again, right? Another night, another Dhamma talk. And here we are together. Yes, alone, and practicing together. These two words that I think I shared with you, it feels like ages ago, right? And I think the first Dhamma talk I gave. That we're here to practice alone and together. And I want to take some time tonight to share some reflections on this aspect of practicing together, navigating each other in silence, and bringing sati, bringing mindfulness to that. Don referred to this both last night and this morning, this being mindful internally and being mindful externally, and that's one way of understanding it. And in particular, the kind of the arena I'm going to be sharing with you is it's mostly for the in-between times. Because if your mind's like my mind, it's like the in-between times where it can feel like it's like party time for my mind. It's like, woohoo, you know, like take a break from mindfulness. And it's such a fascinating aspect of retreat. And what I notice on retreat, especially long retreat, it's so fascinating to me because I find myself bumping into others all the time. Okay, sometimes literally, mostly metaphorically. I mean, it's just interesting practicing, you could say, with other bodies around. What's going on there? What's really going on there? And when I slow down with it, what I notice is I'm just bumping into my own mind. That's what's so fascinating, is making that turn of like, ah, here's the mind again. How is the mind relating to others, to other bodies? Have you noticed this bumping into? Your mind bumping into others? It's bumping into the scene of bodies, just on the periphery. Of course, we're still kind of, you know, guarding where we direct our eyes. But it bumps into the scene of bodies. Sometimes bodies moving, or sometimes bodies that are still. The sounds of bodies. The sounds of bodies walking softly, loudly. The sound of a body striking a bell or eating. The smells of bodies, the thoughts of bodies. They're really just experiences of the senses. But what I notice is from my mind bumping into bodies, from there, it creates people. And sometimes creates them in rather unskillful ways. Maybe you've noticed this. Just an extreme example of this, and really we're going to be talking, I'm going to be sharing more of the subtle domain about this, about a friend who grew up in a family, and the parents were really clear about the kids. It'd be like there was one that they felt was really musically oriented. So when that child became curious about math, they'd be like, oh, you're not good at math. Music is your place. Yeah, you're the musician of the family. And then the child that maybe was more mathematically oriented or in another direction, and they might become curious about the piano, they'd be like, no, you're not good at that. This is your domain. And it was like there was a box for each child like this. Maybe you've experienced this from others. When you get boxed in some way, there's some concept that you have to follow. And then our minds and our bodies get shaped by that. It's so confining and oppressive. And really, the mind is creating others through perception, and then it gets entangled in those perceptions, and then confines people. Anais Nin in an autobiography in her biographical novel. This great quote. She says, "We do not see things as they are; we see them as we are." It's bumping into my mind around those bodies, and we see them as we are in terms of, you know, what we want, what we don't want, what we crave and hate, what we grasp and what we push away, what bothers us and what we're enchanted with. And of course, probably by now you've seen how you do this to yourself all the time. This is the creation of a self. Yet tonight I'm going to invite you to have this curiosity around how we create others, not just ourselves, but the creation of people. Because there's a real gift for freedom, both for ourselves and for the world that we live in. We do not see things as they are. We see them as we are. And we are society. The activity of our minds, right? That activity, it's so much the activity of society. Krishnamurti speaks to this. So appreciate him pointing this out. He says, if you don't know how your mind works, you cannot actually understand what society is. Because your mind is a part of society. It is society. Your reactions, your beliefs, the clothes you wear, the things you do and don't do, and what you think. Society is made up of all of this. It is the replica of what is going on in your own mind. So your mind is not apart from society. It is not distinct from your culture, from your religion, from your various class divisions, from the ambitions and conflicts of the many. All this is society, and you are part of it. Your mind is society. I find it kind of relieving, all those messed up, crazy thoughts, those tendencies. No wonder. The judging of yourself and others, wow, that's the structure of society there. You're striving for success in your meditation, wanting to get something. Boy, that mind makes such a good consumer, huh? It's amazing. Our minds are society. And then Krishnamurti goes on. He says, since the habit of pattern thinking has already been established in you, even if you do revolt, it is within the pattern. I think this is really important. Probably you've noticed this by now. Like, you've tried the revolt and you're like, oh my God, this is just greed, hatred, delusion. Once again, how do I get out of this? And I love it. He says, it is like prisoners in revolting in order to have better food, more conveniences. But it's always within the prison. When you seek God or try to find out what is right to government, it is always within the pattern of society, which says this is true and that is false, this is good and that is bad, this is right, this is the right leader and these are the saints. So your revolt, like the so-called revolution brought about by ambitious or very clever people, is always limited. That's not revolt. That's not true revolution. It's merely heightened activity, a more valiant struggle within the pattern. Real revolt, true revolution, is to break away from the pattern and to inquire outside of it. For me, this is the true revolution. To step outside of this pattern societal thinking and just to see it, to notice what's going on in this mind. I'm sure you've tasted that freedom of seeing, just to see it, how it loosens the bonds. It really is a revolution, I think. And yes, I want to be clear, you know, the ills of society are deep and complex and need a multifaceted approach. But I think this too is part of a revolutionary act. And for me, when I read these early Buddhist texts, I think the Buddha was so down for this. He loved the idea of true revolution. A revolution that would transform the mind and therefore transform society. I mean, this is the Buddha I hear speaking to me when I deeply listen. You know, one place I find this is just like the way the Buddha talks about spiritual awakening in these early texts and how it diverged from many of the notions of awakening found in the Brahminical society surrounding him. For example, one notion of spiritual awakening in the Brahminical tradition was to become one with Brahma. And yet the Buddha diverged from this and he situated awakening, really interestingly, in an ethical dimension. Remember this definition that we keep on coming back to, so many of the teachers, it's a heart free of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so much of the narrative, the language around greed, hatred, and delusion in these early Buddhist texts is its ethical nature of how harm comes from these kalesas. So for me, an important aspect of awakening in these early Buddhist texts is about being in the world in a different way, a way of non-harming. This is awakening. This is a free heart. A letting go, a non-clinging that has this ethical dimension. And then to combine this with some of the critiques he had of the societal dynamics going on around him. For example, sometimes you hear of a Brahmin coming up to the Buddha and asking him, you know, what does he think of this Brahminical societal system that divides people into four classes, with the Brahmins being superior and others being inferior. In a system that was mostly based on the family you were born into. And his sentiment was, this is a little bit loose translation, but his sentiment was, that's not cool. Just because someone was born into a certain family doesn't make them better than others. And he's pointed about this. A Brahmin asked him about this idea of Brahmins being born from the mouth of God. That's what makes them superior. You know, we're born from the mouth of God. And he was like, yeah, no, I know that you've been born from a mother's womb just like everybody else. That's just not true. That's not cool what you're doing. And you see this, you know, there's another place, I think, in the Asukari Sutta, where he takes this other approach. He basically points out that if one person serves another person and ends up being better off, having more wholesomeness in their lives, wonderful, right? If one person serves another person and it's good for them, it's wholesome, it's great. Yet if one person serves another person and they end up worse off, not so good. It's not cool. That has a whole implications for economic systems. So this sensitivity to ethics, to non-harming, and then to the society that we find ourselves thrown into. And I want to point out, I feel like him pointing to these societal dynamics is so intertwined with how we create people from bodies. Even here at IMS on a long retreat. Because there can be so much harm if we get entangled in that unskillfully. Like the example I gave you about that family. And the Buddha gives a specific practice around this. It's the practice of sense restraint or guarding the senses. It's one of the parts of the what's called the gradual training, which you find is repeated again and again in many of these early Buddhist texts. And it's a term that's so commonly misunderstood, guarding the senses and sense restraint. Because sometimes the way it's talked about, and we use this phrase too, I know sometimes I'll use this phrase, where it's thought that what it means is not to look at things, or to close your ears. And someone actually came up to the Buddha and said, asked him this, you know, do we just need to be blind and deaf for guarding the senses? He's like, no, that's not what I'm talking about. It's something really quite different than that. So I want to explain how guarding the senses is different from that. And I want to acknowledge here we are in this, it's a weird culture, it's retreat culture, where we are keeping the eyes guarded in this other way of not looking around a lot in that sense. It can be really helpful just being together in silence. You know, and at the same time, I'm sure you're aware of different bodies, just in a nanosecond in terms of the information that the mind imparts. So here's the Buddha's description of guarding the senses, and please listen carefully because it's, you know, it's the sometimes a difficult language in terms of these texts. So he says, on seeing a form with the eye, a practitioner does not grasp at any themes or details. We'll get to those. By which, if they were to dwell without restraint over the faculty of the eye, unskillful qualities such as greed or distress might assail them. Right? And then he goes through all the other senses, on hearing a sound with an ear, a smell, an odor, and on. So sense restraint here, given what he just said, it's that after contact, it's not grasping at the themes or secondary characteristics of sense objects. So what are those? For tonight, I'm going to keep it super simple to keep it within our practice. These two Pali words, basically, they're basically just the initial perceptions that arise from the experience of a sense object. So let me give some examples of this. And it'll hopefully bring together a lot of what I'm talking about. So, for example, you're kind of mindfully walking in the dining hall or down a hall, and a body passes by. And as the body passes by, there's the eye, there is the arising of eye consciousness, and the form of a sense of a body there. And those come together. That's, as we know now, contact. There's contact there. And from that contact, from that, there are themes and details around that are perceived in terms of that object, that body. In other words, perceptions arise in the mind. It might be the perception of a general sense of the age of that body. You know, when I mention this kind of perception, it can be so subtle. It could be pre-verbal. It's not like I have the word older or younger in the mind. There's just this initial hit or initial sense of that body. It could be the briefest kind of eye contact that happens. And there is that sense, oh, an older person, oh, a younger person. And the Buddha is saying, if you were to grasp at those perceptions, like that perception, get entangled with that perception, you could possibly do something quite harmful. And in some ways, you would be just like those Brahmins who utilize a kind of social system that is oppressive. You're kind of mindfully walking down a hall. There's a body, there's eye consciousness, and a form, contact. Oh, older body, younger body. And then what can arise from that? And you know this, I know that Annie spoke about this too, is what comes after this. And we've spoken about this in so many ways. The arising of liking and not liking, wanting or not wanting. Just a subtle grasping or aversion. It can be so subtle. And sometimes the eyes get pulled in as a result, or there's a disregarding of that body as a subtle aversion. And when the mind gets entangled in that way, it renders some people as visible and others invisible in our minds. And thus renders some people of more value than others. Just around the perception of older body or a younger body. But in terms of walking down the hall, a person you probably have never really met, maybe had a 10-minute conversation with, you have no idea about them. We do not see things as they are. We see them as we are. And the activity of these minds are society at times. There's one very large study that was using data from over 700,000 participants. It was it's called an implicit biased test. Just to keep it simple, implicit bias is it's kind of the attitudes that the mind has, or the kind of the language of this retreat. It's kind of like how the mind initially reacts to contact. And a kind of reaction that goes mostly unnoticed, that is just below the surface of what we're aware of. So here's the study. And in this study, you know, data from 700,000 participants, it's the flashing of images of people appearing to be different ages, just faces of people flashing really quite quickly. And out of this data, what they found is that there was an implicit bias against older-looking bodies and an implicit bias towards younger-looking bodies. And it was found to be the case in participants of all ages. And what was also so interesting about this is also tracking what's called explicit bias. Explicit bias is what we tell people when they ask us about these things. And what we usually tell people is like, I'm a good person. I'm actually a meditator. You know, I do Buddhist meditation and I'm a really good person. I'm so beyond those biases. What's called explicit bias. And the explicit bias that was in most contrast to the implicit bias, it was from older people. So just because when we get older doesn't mean that we stop having biases against older people. Sometimes we just don't see it. So the practice is not to get the mind to stop fabricating these themes or details, such as age around a body, but not to get hooked by them, by the associations that society has taught us, the greed and aversion that society has taught us around these perceptions. This is the true revolution. This changes society. There's so much ageism in society. You know, workplace discrimination in regard to age, just studies coming out about that, it's so huge, the discrimination that happens around age. And the invisibility that happens to all of us as we grow older. This happens in so many ways. You know, you're kind of mindfully walking down the hall. A body passes. There's contact. Themes and details arise in the mind. Perceptions arise. Oh, the perception man, woman. It might even be pre-verbal. It's not like those words come up. But there's that sense. There's a body. Oh, that's the body of a woman. Oh, that's the body of a man. If you were to grasp at those perceptions, get entangled with them, you might do something quite harmful if you got entangled in them. You might just be like those Brahmins and utilize a kind of social system that's quite oppressive. Especially around gender. I mean, it's amazing, right? We have no idea, probably of most of the bodies here, how that person identifies themselves in terms of gender. They might not identify with either man or woman. And yet it feels like from that perception we know, doesn't it? Oh, there it is. There's that perception. We do not see things as they are. We see them as we are. In our minds are a society. Gender bias still exists in all kinds of ways. In hiring practices of companies, and the pay wage gap between people who identify as women and people who identify as men. And the list goes on, the straitjackets and the confinement of gender. Again, we're not trying to stop perceptions like these from happening. It's just not to be enchanted by them. Kind of mindfully walking down the hall. And a body passes. So quick. It's not like you're looking at it, but there's a sense of it. Contact. And then those themes and details, those perceptions, the size of those bodies, the skin color of those bodies, the ability of those bodies, the ways bodies move or don't move. Right here at IMS. If you were to grasp at those perceptions, get entangled them, it might just be like those Brahmins who utilize a kind of societal system that is oppressive. There's so many biases around certain bodies. The size of bodies, it's when they've done the studies around how implicit bias has increased or decreased over the last couple decades. One of the implicit biases that has actually increased, many have gone down, for example, sexual orientation. One of the beauties is the implicit bias against folks who are not heterosexual has decreased, which I think is so cool. Around the size of bodies, increased. Again, implicit bias, not explicit bias. Well, I got all kinds of friends like that. I ain't biased. How's the mind? The mind, society. Or around skin color bias. You know, there was a recent study from the University of Michigan studying wrongful convictions, data around wrongful convictions. In the U.S. here, innocent people who are black are 7 times more likely to be convicted of murder than innocent white people. And when it comes to drug crimes, innocent black people were 12 times more likely to be convicted than innocent white people. Right, just around the way we perceive bodies. And this is just the visual field. We hear bodies sometimes moving loudly, sometimes softly, smell bodies, we think about bodies. And if I were to grasp at those perceptions, get entangled with them, I might do something quite harmful. Be just like those Brahmins who utilize a kind of system that is quite oppressive. We do not see things as they are, we see them as we are. And yes, I want to point out, I'm simplifying this. It's so complex what happens just in a moment of contact and how the mind perceives and how it gets entangled in these. But I show this to show the relevance for what we're doing here for the world that we live in. It's actually been a smaller study around mindfulness and implicit bias and how mindfulness can help release the heart and mind from such dynamics. So now what I want to do is I want to get a little bit more in detail about engaging in this practice of sense restraint and to maybe play around with this in the in-between times. Just because there's some things about it that I found so helpful. And to do this, what I'm going to have you do is I'm going to have you to open your eyes and just to see what happens around this visual cue. So you're going to have to open your eyes and you're going to have to look up here. You have to wait for the surprise. So what do you notice going on right now? I know it's probably maybe gone into the world of Papancha of like, was Brian smoking something before he came in here? Is this really going on at IMS? He did seem a little strange in my practice meeting today. But what are your eyes, in particular, what do you know notice your eyes doing around this object? What does it do? Because I'm not so curious about, we could talk about the object. But it's like to notice what happened with the eyes. Because this is about sense restraint. That's a little difficult. And one of the reasons why it's so difficult is one of the things that happens to the eyes is when there's an object that is highly unusual in the environment. Which might be like this. Pulls the eyes, doesn't it? Did you feel how the eyes come alive when there's something unusual in your environment? No. Just right there. And I'm sure you've noticed maybe you're going for walking meditation and there's just a chipmunk that runs by. There's something unusual and then it pulls the eyes. This is the beginning of what I'm talking about. This is the beginning of contact and then themes and details. Because my eyes get pulled when, one, there's something unusual, it's novel. And there's a reason for this, right? Is it something dangerous? There's something new in the environment. I got to see if it's dangerous or if it's food. It's not food. So we're geared in this way, but it's also the beginning. It can be the environment for the beginning of grasping and aversion around that. And then also, what was I doing? Right, what was I doing? I was moving it. Movement, have you noticed this? It's so fascinating just to check out how the eyes get pulled. For example, in the dining hall, you might remember Joseph was talking about this. He gave you this instruction, just to label seeing. And now take it a step further. How is that seeing happen? Like when I'm in the dining room, one of the things I notice is sometimes it's subtle movement that catches the eye, especially in the periphery. That's how peripheral vision works, is it's catching movement. And then it's like even before my mindfulness is there, I'm drawn, I'm like staring at like somebody getting a bowl of rice or something, you know. It can be so mundane, but there is this sense where there's no sense restraint. It's like just following, the attention of the eyes get pulled. And then it's from there where you might notice that from that is where the liking, not liking, the wanting, the not wanting, that's situated around perceptions, around how bodies move, happens. So to check that out, what are the eyes doing? What's happening just in that moment? I'm thinking this might not be the best object for this, but we're going to give this a try. What I want to invite you to do is to see if you can relax the eyes back into your sockets. So it's allowing the eyes to have a soft focus. And it's like just resting and opening the visual field. And also noticing how the body feels different when you rest the eyes. To me, this is when I learned this about sense restraint, something different opened up. Where sense restraint wasn't restraint, it was an opening. That's how I can restrain the eyes from getting lost in the details and the themes of things. And to feel the eyes relaxing. To play with that, especially inside the building. Like, I love the dining room. It is so awesome for that. Or when you're walking down the hall, what's it like to relax the eyes like that? And I get the sense of the eyes open. And it's like just like allowing them to, oh yeah, resting in the eye sockets right now. Allowing for relaxation. And if you can get a feeling for that, to also now allow this in the activity of hearing right now. Because sometimes if I feel it in the visual field, it's easier for me to feel it in the activity of hearing. It's like, oh yeah, there it is, just to rest back and allowing sounds to come and go. I invite you to feel that right now. To rest the ears, like opening that sense gate. And if you can get a feeling for the eyes to rest back, the ears to rest and open, sometimes what I do after that is allowing the mind to rest right now. And it can feel similar to the eyes resting and the ears resting. And sometimes when I allow the mind to rest like that, it's like, oh, it's now the feeling of thoughts can come, but the mind isn't grabbing as much. It's just there. It gives me a sense of, oh, this is why the mind is a sense gate. It can be opened in a way. It can be guarded by opening. So to make sure to understand this word restraint or guarding in terms of opening the senses, you might feel some of that. When the senses are open, a lot of times they don't grab as much around sense objects. And yeah, this grabbing is very subtle, because what I notice around, just like the scene of bodies, is there can be a kind of a pull to some visual object, and then there's a liking and wanting and kind of a pull into the object. Or sometimes what happens is there's a grabbing, but in a way that then the mind disregards that body. Because remember, especially with implicit bias, a lot of times with these categories I was sharing with you, there's a kind of invisibility that happens around certain bodies and a hypervisibility around other bodies. Sometimes that's dependent upon craving and other times around aversion. This is sense restraint. And you could even play with it in the realm of smelling, tasting, and feeling sensations. So this is one part of guarding the senses of sense restraint. Understanding it in terms of opening the senses so they're more relaxed. So again, you can play around with this in the in-between times. And then with that, sometimes I'll put in the question, and I'll have to explain this question, what is seeing? And this is a little bit different than, you know, some of the questions that Joseph was giving you a few nights ago. And what I mean by this question is, or what is hearing, or what is tasting, is what's the mind state that's happening around seeing or happening around hearing? Wanting, interesting. Oh, not wanting. Oh, that's what's seeing right now. There's a not wanting seeing right now. Grasping, aversion. And even more importantly, asking the question, and what you notice, oh, mindfulness is seeing right now. Oh, sati is here. Oh, equanimity is here seeing right now. Oh, there isn't any contention with experience right now. The experience of the senses just sensing without the complication to notice that in the in-between times. It can just be for a moment. And a whole world opens up to see the absence, to notice the absence in the activity of hearing or smelling or tasting or seeing. And the word that comes to mind to get a feeling sense of when the senses are just there without getting entangled is this the Pali word is tatata, suchness. Suchness later on in Buddhism, especially in Zen, becomes kind of a central theme in the Dharma. It is found in the Pali texts, used a little bit differently sometimes. So what is suchness? Sometimes it's translated as, you know, just as things are. So I want to, again, give an example of this, a visual example of this. So a bell, right? There's a bell here. And this bell, don't get all meditative on me, this is just a very simple thing, right? It's smaller than this bell here, right? We have the big bell and we have the small bell. And often this is how we interact with the world, is through some kind of comparison, right? There's older bodies and there's younger bodies. There's larger bodies and there's skinnier bodies. We assess in this way. But it can change so quickly, right? Oh! Well, maybe this is the big bell and this is the small bell. Oh, interesting. There's nothing inherent about these perceptions in the object. And what is suchness? It's just this. Can you get a small taste of that? Suchness is just this. Not big, not small, no comparison. It's just this right now. As it is. Can you taste the suchness of momentary experience? The suchness of those around you. Just this. As it is, to taste the heart that's not entangled. That's there. Together. And it's in that suchness, it's in that suchness that then we can truly take in another being in a way that really is the true revolution. That's bringing in to being a different society, a different way of being together that's really very radical. Maybe just like those lines from the end of that poem I shared with you around death, when we really take in the possibility of another being dying. And Ellen Bass says, "How close does the dragon spume have to come? How wide does the crack in heaven have to be split? What would people look like if we could see them as they are? Soaked in honey, stung and swollen, reckless and pinned against time." What would people look like if we could see them as they are? Soaked in honey, stung and swollen, reckless, and pinned against time. This, I feel, is the true revolution. And may it be a true revolution that leads to the liberation of all beings. Just sit for a moment now.